Edited by Sonia Hernandez and John Moran Gonzalez, Reverberations of Racial Violence is a collection of essays that detail systematic extralegal killings of Mexicans along the U.S.-Mexican borderlands and particularly in South Texas from 1910 to 1919. As Hernandez and Gonzalez write in their introduction, the essays place the traumatic events north of the Rio Grande into a transporter history to jumpstart a conversation about state violence, white supremacy, and the resilience of communities of color. Sonia Hernandez is an associate professor of history and the former director of the Latino, Latina, and Mexican American Studies program at Texas A&M University. She is the author of Working Women Into the Borderlands. John Moran Gonzalez is the J. Frank Dobie Regents Professor of American and English Literature and director of the Center for Mexican American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. He is the author of Border Renaissance, The Texas Centennial, and the Emergence of Mexican-American Literature. Sonia Hernandez and John Moran Gonzalez, editors of Reverberation of Racial Violence, Critical Reflections on the History of the Border. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Houghton.
Great to be here.
I want to start off with who I think is the pivotal person that is responsible for all the scholarship and the work that's being done around violence on the border in terms of the work that he did. And that's Jose Tomas Canales. He was a Brownsville landowner. He was an attorney, civic leader, and state representative who launched a state legislative investigation in 1919, exposing the violence committed by Texas Rangers between 1910 and 1920 against predominantly Texas-Mexico border communities. And for me, he is a forgotten hero, a hero that we didn't even know about. So talk a bit about, starting with you, Sonia, discovering this heroic figure that was sort of lost in the testimony that was kept under basically lock and key for 50 years.
Well, thanks for that question, Houghton, and thanks for having us. Jose Tomas Canales, better known as JT Canales, is exactly what how you just define him. He's a hero, but he was also a human being with faults of his own. But you know, it wasn't until the early 1970s that historian James Sandoz had access to what were the transcripts of the Canales hearings, what became known as the Canales hearings, which was the first state-led investigation into Texas Ranger violence. And so it is Canales that emerges as a representative of the Mexican Texan community during this time period, during the 19 teens, and exposes the Texas Rangers for what they were. They committed murderous acts, indiscriminate acts of violence, and he emerges as a champion for the Mexican American community. And in 2019, John and I were just thrilled to organize an NEH sponsored conference that marked the centennial of that very state-led investigation. And so this was a reflection around the topic of the state's role in racial violence, a public dialogue that we held at the Bob Bullock State Museum that led to what became then the anthology featuring these scholarly essays around this topic. So the essays in this anthology all sort of reflect upon not just this moment of racial violence and of Canales' role as a civil rights leader, but also in terms of the civil rights movement that the hearings provoked. So, you know, while at the same time we wanted to, you know, capture this really dark moment in our state's history, we also wanted to discuss and reflect upon the way in which the community responded to such state violence.
And John, the book features 14 essays, but also two poems, and the book is divided into three parts. Talk a little bit about recruiting your contributors and some of the editorial decisions you made in putting together Reverberations of Racial Violence.
Well, we were fortunate to be able to recruit folks who had been scholars in the field for decades sometimes, as well as more recent scholars. And so we brought them all together, as Sonia indicated, as part of the Canales investigation conference that was held at the Bob Bullock Texas State History Museum in 2019. And we were able to have 3 days of incredible scholarship and testimony from the audience, from descendants, and from, you know, even college students and high school students. They all participated in this. And so we were able to bring it all together in this anthology in an expanded form, you know, to hopefully reach a wider audience for this. So we were really building on decades of scholarship and just bringing it together, I think, for the public in a kind of compact way. And now we hope that it just reaches as wide an audience as possible.
One of the stories in the book that struck me was the essay by Christopher Carmona, who's a professor at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. And he tells this story about being at a conference and talking to one of his colleagues who's a professor at the University of Texas at San Antonio. And they're having a conversation about the atrocities committed by the Texas Rangers against ethnic Mexican and Mexican Americans. And she has with her a graduate student who is mouth is wide open in disbelief about the stories. And she tells them that her ideas of what the Texas Rangers represented were solely formed by Walker, Texas Ranger, and the Lone Ranger. And it inspired him to start writing stories about a Mexican superhero from the Valley, light-skinned, who goes undercover as a Texas Ranger. And John and Sonia, I just thought that was such an incredible story because it seems we're really in the position now that, especially with what's happened with the Texas legislature, it's even more important the work that scholars and professors and the community does to educate our communities, our students, not only about the stories of the past, the atrocities committed, but also the fight and the spirit of fighting against the atrocities and the spirit of resistance and resilience. So Sonia, as a historian, how important is it, do you think, today that these stories are being told, not just in the schools, but outside of the schools?
Upton, I think it's incredibly important. I mean, this anthology could not have come out at a more crucial time. And you're right, you know, as these attacks on anything that is really essentially like, you know, real history or any history that begs some critical reflection, you know, is now under attack. So creative works like Christopher Carmona's is a series, creative writing series, El Rinche, are just incredibly important. So Professor Carmona takes historical facts and then puts them in this different platform, which is, I think, as a historian, I highly respect my profession, but I mean, I've learned so much from creative writers, from sociologists, from anthropologists, who then take these platforms that have just this great potential to reach wider audiences, and especially young audiences. I mean, that is the future of Texas. And it is an incredible and powerful way to keep this these histories alive, like the Canales hearings. And Christopher Carmona examined those hearings, just as the other scholars in the anthology did, and then puts this information in a highly accessible platform that really piques young people's curiosity. So we were just thrilled to have Christopher Carmona participate in our anthology.
And if I might add, Hopeton, it was incredibly important for us to include not only Chris Carmona's piece about his, you know, the genesis of that series, series of novels around El Rinche, but also to have other contemporary expressive practices like poetry in the volume. So the opening poem by Noreen Rivera and the closing one by Nati Roman, you know, were incredibly important because it also gestures towards, I think what we wanted to do was kind of break down this artificial barrier of understanding between fiction and history. That is, you know, there's often this sense that, oh, fiction is false, history is fact. But in fact, when people of color are denied their history, that is the ability to gain the credentials to write official histories, they turn to poetry and prose fiction in order to tell those stories. That was true back, you know, in the 20s, 30s, and it's true today. So we wanted to acknowledge that there is truth in, you know, literature, and that can be, you know, tells a story from angles that often are missing from state-sanctioned narratives.
There's an essay, The World of Education Among Ethnic Mexican and J.T. Canales' South Texas by Philip M. Barr, Reagan Goetz, and Carlos K. Blanton. And the reason I wanted to bring that up, because in that particular essay, they talk about how the public schools were used to further the story state as written of human relations through an intentional disparagement of Mexican culture. And that's why this battle in terms of what is taught in the public schools is so important, because it shapes the view that the students have. And the public schools have been used for so many years, in my opinion, to further white supremacy, to just make things that happened in the past to change the narrative and tell the story that puts a certain community in a heroic light, and the other communities it disparages.
That that essay, thank you for bringing that up, Hopeton. I mean, that essay written by historians Barragán Goetz and Blanton, it's another incredible piece. I mean, all of these, we can't say enough about all of these scholarly essays, but this one in particular shows how this, you know, the racialization of Mexican Americans extended, you know, to all different aspects of society, and certainly affected, as the title suggests, the world of Mexican American education. And so there was sort of another war waged on the Mexican origin community, and, you know, preventing children from learning their full history, the segregation of Mexican American children, keeping Mexican American children retaining them for another year simply because they spoke Spanish, or simply because they were of Mexican origin. And so that essay examines not only that, the extent of this sort of, you know, racialization, racial war on the Mexican American community in the realm of education, but it also shows the way in which the community responded to these moments. And like it always has, Mexican Americans responded by collectively pulling their resources and creating their own schools. So you have the emergence of escuelitas, or these little schools that popped up throughout places like South Texas and further north. And these were schools that oftentimes, you know, they lacked resources like textbooks, but they nonetheless were able to acquire poetry, histories, art from the community itself to share with the students and to keep that that history alive. And so it's one of these chapters that really gives us a lot of hope, especially with respect to what's happening today, that communities of color for decades have found ways to keep those memories alive, and they press on. They continue to press on.
And John, what are your thoughts about how popular culture and literature, for example, the movie The Birth of a Nation, and how they are used to justify the oppression of people of color?
Absolutely. I mean, popular culture has often worked hand in hand education to promulgate a kind of narrative of white supremacy in this country. So Birth of a Nation goes hand in hand with all the erection of, you know, Confederate memorials and statues in, you know, creating a kind of Jim Crow state. Now, likewise, the same is true for Mexican American history. In fact, right at the time, and it's often thought of as a companion piece to Birth of a Nation, is a film called Martyrs of the Alamo, which basically helps set up the kind of narrative of the treacherous, cruel, and tyrannical Mexican that would be central to white supremacist narratives of the following century. So, and really in the sense that because much of Texas history mythology, especially around the Texas Rangers, were not set up in the 19th century mode of Confederate statues surrounding town squares, but rather in popular culture itself, that is through radio, film, television, that it's it's much harder to take down, right? You know, it's much harder to address when it's dispersed throughout popular culture rather than specifically and materially located, say, in a town square. So the hard work of kind of demythologizing the Texas Rangers in particular, I think still remains to be done.
And if I may, Hope Jen, I mean, I couldn't agree with John more. Just in my classes, every time I covered this period in history, I still have students saying like, well, wait a minute, can you repeat that? Because, you know, I remember, you know, the Rangers always standing up for the community. And these are, you know, the defenders of the law. And so this, I mean, this has really, it's made it quite difficult for us historians to, you know, to lecture on this, to talk about this. And it's really deeply rooted. And there's this sense of sort of if you bring up these hard facts, and they're uncomfortable facts and uncomfortable truths, right? That makes one less Texan, or if I may, less American. And because it's so deeply ingrained, right? Deeply rooted and some was sort of part of you know, Texan identity. But in many ways, you know, it's so much more difficult because that's ingrained in popular culture and, you know, in dime novels and in recent popular culture films. I mean, was it a year or 2 years ago? Was it the Netflix special featuring the, Rangers that captured Bonnie and Clyde? I mean, so that's still very much with us today.
To what degree did Walter Prescott Webb in his 1935, as described in your book, Hagiography, the Texas Rangers, was written really to, as written in your one of your essays in the book, to counter the image of the Rangers left by the Canales hearings. So the dominant community has always sought to use popular culture and history and literature to create a narrative that uplifts the mythology that they want to put upon all of Texas, even often when it doesn't agree with the facts in the history.
Wow. So what really struck me, what set Walter Prescott Webb on his path, right, of kind of becoming the hagiographer, right, the kind of celebrating in academic culture of the Texas Rangers, was the Canales hearing. He's a young man, and shortly after the Canales hearing in the early 1920s, he writes his master's thesis on the Texas Rangers in history, and it's the seed of what will become the Texas Rangers book of 1935. Why does he write it? Precisely because he sees the Rangers in danger from community actions like the hearings, right? I mean, prior to this, nobody really needed to write a defense or apology for the Rangers. It was just considered common sense. But by the 1920s, it's become something the kind of unregulated extra-legal violence that the Rangers often used against communities of color needed defending, right, at a kind of intellectual level. And so Webb then devotes a good part of his career to doing just that, right, to creating kind of an academic kind of defense and apology of the Rangers. So in other words, from my point of view, I see it very much as coming from a kind of sign that the facade of white supremacy has these hairline cracks, and that he's trying to plaster it over with his scholarship. So yes, absolutely. Webb was a dominant force in the history department at UT Austin for decades in the mid 20th century. And, you know, we're still chipping away at that legacy.
A couple of years ago, during the Diversity Voices of Texas celebration, we had a panel discussion with Monica Munoz Martinez, author of The Injustice Never Leaves You, one of the contributing essayists to your book, Reverberations of Racial Violence, Critical Reflections on the History of the Border, that also had Gary Bledsoe on that panel. And that was during the time period when they discovered a bunch of graves in Sugar Land, Texas, of apparently African-Americans who had been worked to death. And I think to what degree is it important that as we have these separate narratives of oppression and lynching and violence against us, that we talk together and talk about the commonality of the experiences that we have, because we're both part of this Texas community oppressed in different ways. And one example is the story of the Valley and part of the effort of wanting to take away the land ownership of ethnic Mexicans in the Valley who owned ranches, and that whole power struggle to take over that particular land. Sometimes there are different stories, sometimes there's similar stories, but how important is it that our two communities, Black and ethnic Mexicans, come together to discuss this commonality of our histories?
I think it's extremely important to place this in comparative perspective. In fact, when we organized the conference at the Bullock Museum, we had, there were many more contributors to the conference. We could only fit a certain amount of chapters in the anthology, of course, but the public dialogue was much wider, and it was a real sort of collaborative discussion. We talked about, at the conference, we talked about the African-American experience, particularly in the Deep South, gender violence and lynching, the Chinese American community out in the West Coast, and certainly the ethnic Mexican community in places like the Rio Grande Valley. And so there are numerous similarities, like you just mentioned, land dispossession, but there's also, economic competition is one of the chapters written by William Kerrigan and Clive Webb point to in terms of the African-American lynching experience, if you will, and compared to that, to the Mexican-American one. And so there's certainly those parallels. And there are also those moments of community resiliency that I think is so important and that I want to keep stressing, because we didn't just want to, our intention was not to portray a history of victimization. And it's really important to point out community resiliency and the community response to these moments of violence. And so this is, it's extremely important to place this in comparative perspective, because this is a broader American, the broader American experience for communities of color. When we look at these histories next to each other, we not only learn that racialized ideas and state violence form part of nation making, but we also learned that there were numerous ways, there were numerous moments of resistance on the part of these communities, and that they were not just standing idle. And this is, these are unfortunate moments and these are hard truths, but this is part of our history. And this is part of, the making of the United States. And it's extremely important especially for young people to know this history, because, if they are old enough to experience these moments of discrimination, unfortunately, that are still happening today, they should know this history as well.
And John, one of the things that you successfully did is when you published your book on the Texas Centennial of 1936, and you made it a point to make sure that there was representation of the history of Texas, not just from an Anglo perspective, but also from an ethnic Mexican perspective. So talk about the importance not only of us knowing our history, but whites knowing the true history of ethnic Mexicans.
Yes, absolutely. I think the history of hard truths that Sonia's referred to is really one that is at odds with the kind of mythologized history that unfortunately most students in Texas have grown up with. And so the problem, I think Sonia pointed it out well when she saw there's this cognitive dissonance that occurs when, a respected, educator, professor is saying one thing, and it's at odds with everything that they think they know about a topic, like the Texas Rangers always being the good guys. Well, that ain't so. It's important to, one, be upfront about it, that, there has been a history of conflict, oftentimes quite violent in Texas, as well as moments of deep cooperation. And so, in other words, history is messy, history is complex, and history has actors who act according to the best of their abilities and to their community interests. And so we're trying to capture all of that. I think those moments in history that Sonia kind of, tend to be left out are in fact the ones of not simply conflict with, say, a dominant Anglo one, but also moments of cooperation between communities of color. So I'm going to cite, like, now kind of the scholarship on the Southern Path of the Underground Railroad. right, where Mexican border communities helped African Americans escape slavery. I mean, I think that's a hugely important chapter that is just really beginning to get fleshed out. You know, there are other moments where, you know, we have to not forget that Webb, even in his Texas Rangers book, is really saying that it blows against not only Mexicans, but African Americans and Native Americans as well. And the kind of that history, what you alluded to earlier about the finding of graves of, Jim Crow era African Americans who were, basically worked to get to death. You know, I that has a deep resonance with what's going on with the discovery of, graves of Native American children in Canadian boarding schools. I mean, they're all victims of state violence. But it also tells me that, one, these issues have not been forgotten in the present. You know, a century or more may have passed, but these communities are still absolutely dedicated to the idea of social justice and restitution. Right, that these are not the unforgotten dead, but rather it's an immediate living issue to organize around.
The last question I want to ask is about a history professor and an English professor working together. And there are some that may say, well, you know, history is very different from English, but as I'm sure you know, Sonia, when we read history, we want to read books that we enjoy reading. And when we read literature, John, I love literature and novels that are based on true history. So talk a bit about the importance of these two disciplines working together.
Well, you know, one of the things that I always tell my students and what could be called like historiography 101, we call it at Texas A&M University, we call it the historian's craft. And so all history majors have to take that. That I tell them, you know, historians did not just emerge as historians all on their own. Historians in the past and today, use a multiplicity of sources coming from different disciplines. So yes, of course, we spend a lot of time in the archives looking at primary sources, you know, government records, labor records, newspaper articles, those kinds of things. We also look at literary pieces, creative works, data collection by sociologists, ethnographic reports by cultural anthropologists. So, I just working with John just felt very natural. And there's so many similarities. I mean, you know, just look at his past scholarship and then just the topic of this anthology, it just made perfect sense. So for me, it was a very welcoming experience, but a very sort of natural one.
Well, I'll just echo what Sonia said, but that it really was a tremendous pleasure working with Sonia on this, and for all kinds of reasons. And I'll just speak to the kind of question that both history and literature speak to narrative and interpretation, right? That's where their kind of intersection lies. And they have developed historically different methodologies. They are housed in different areas, but really I think in the best ways can speak to each other, right? That is, literature can learn from history some of the archival methods and the kind of sense like, well, it's, you know, that there's incredible value to that kind of research for understanding, you know, texts or literature. I think conversely, I think what literature kind of may help to bring to historians is that question of interpretation, right? Literary studies is all about interpretation, that is not assuming a kind of stability of text or of a single narrative of truth, but rather of the way that one constructs narratives and the way one interprets, you know, something akin to the truth. So it's been an incredibly productive relationship, and I just really have enjoyed being able to be part of it.
Sonia Hernandez and John Barón Gonzalez, editors of Reverberation of Racial Violence, Critical Reflections on the History of the Border. Thank you so much for being guests on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you for having us, Hopeton.
Yes, thanks, Hopeton, again.